We owe a vote of thanks to a group of men and women yesterday, I'm not going to read their names, who spent several hours in this building lowering the chandeliers and putting the globes on them. The saga of the lights is not entirely over. We're still missing something, but it may be by late summer. I would like to mention only one thing that's in the bulletin, and that is, I hope some of you will want to help the Eden Mennonite Church rebuild its facility. They have a marvelous reputation for helping others. I hope we'll want to help them. People respect it, even if they don't know what to make of it. It tops the bestseller list year after year, but most of the people who buy it read very little of it. I'm talking about the Bible, of course. That book which William Tyndale, 450 years ago, translated into English so that everyone in his country could read it. He said to a church leader who opposed him, "If God spare my life, ere many years shall pass, I will cause a boy that driveth the plow to know more of Scripture than you do." The translation cost him his life. And the irony is that today, with dozens of English translations available, the average English-speaking person still does not understand the Bible very well at all. For one thing, we still have trouble with its language, even when we bring it up to date as much as we can with modern versions like Phillips and the Living Bible and Good News for Modern Man. There are still code phrases like the Son of Man, applied to Jesus, with capital letters, which is not the same as the Son of Man with lowercase letters. And what does it mean? Exactly. Or Paul's talking about the prince of the power of the air in that strange book of Colossians where he populates the sky with spirits and demons. Someone tells us that it is a metaphor for Satan, but that only restates the problem, for we don't know if we can believe in the existence of a personal evil being. We may, of course, use the word Satan as a poetic personification of evil, but we still face the question of whether this is what the Bible intended to say. For another thing, we have trouble understanding the Bible writers because we live in a different world from their three-level universe that totally ignores galaxies and supernovas and black holes and talks about God as being up in heaven as if the world were flat and up were a single direction, not a different one for a man in New York and his sister in Hong Kong. If it were an easy book, like Russell Baker's Growing Up, which I'm reading at the moment, or my CPR manual, which I stopped to look at last night, no emergency, I just wanted to review it, we'd all pretty well agree on what it says. But Alexander Campbell read it differently from his friends and founded the Christian churches and the Church of Christ. And John Wesley read it his way and founded the Methodist Church. And John Knox read it his way and became the father of Presbyterians. And Roger Williams read it his way and gave us millions of Baptists, and on until we now have more than 300 churches built on different understandings of what the Bible teaches. So am I saying we should not bother to read it, since even scholars disagree about some parts of it? Not at all. I'm only saying that it is not easy, and that if we're going to avoid making gross mistakes with it, we shall have to give it the same respect we would give to a course in Shakespeare or in Milton. Most of us don't. We hear what preachers say, and if they talk persuasively enough, we believe them, rather gladly, in fact, because it keeps us from having to find out whether they have done a good, sound job of interpretation. We feel quite incapable of teaching our own children about it, so we turn them over to someone else for an hour or less in Sunday school, and we hope that somehow or other they will get enough to make them turn out well and learn enough Bible to qualify as religiously literate. The plan doesn't work very well. A Princeton professor named Walter Kaufman, in a book called The Faith of a Heretic, says that organized religion, that's us, does a poor job educating children about the Bible. We may indoctrinate them in a few of our pet ideas, he says, so that Methodist kids know what the Methodists want them to know, and the Baptist kids know what the Baptists feel is important, but this is not what he means by education. Whatever organized religion in the 20th century is doing, he says, it certainly is not exposing the young to the Old or the New Testament. Students at our leading colleges and universities who have attended Sunday school for years and still attend church with reasonable frequency display the most appalling ignorance of Scripture. 15 years ago, I got a chance to check out Mr. Kaufman's conviction when I took on a university course entitled The Bible as Literature. I jumped at the chance, despite warnings that some students would expect it to be an extension of the Sunday school or a confirmation of what they already believed, or a kind of evangelical experience in which they would join forces with the professor to convert any eligible pagan who happened to drop in. It was exciting, frustrating sometimes, but exciting. We had everything from Jesus freaks to atheists, from emotional Pentecostals to staid Episcopalians, from those who said they'd never read a word of the Bible to those who were gloriously positive they knew far more about it than any professor could ever hope to know. And as you would guess, those were the tough ones to deal with. It was almost impossible to get them to look at the Bible with clear, unbiased eyes because they were sure they already knew everything about it that was worth knowing. And in one sense, they did know quite a bit, some of them. That is, they knew the highly selective parts of the Bible, which their churches felt it was important to know, and which it taught them over and over in Sunday school and from the pulpit. What they did not know, and what hit them with an unwelcome kind of culture shock, was what the Bible really shows itself to be when we sit down to study it objectively and critically as we would study any other great and difficult and rewarding document. They found strange, bizarre stories which no Sunday school teacher or minister had ever mentioned and which threatened to upset their whole concept of what the Bible is and how it was written. They had heard how simple the Bible is. Just pick it up and read it through from cover to cover. Even the Boy Scouts used to make this part of the program. One of my students told me on Wednesday. And there will be something magical in moving the eye over every page. No one had told them that a surprising amount of the Bible is irrelevant to modern life, that some of it is contradictory and confusing, and that all of it is a mixture of literary forms that require special reading skills if the writer is to be understood as he meant to be. Let me illustrate with one oddity out of hundreds, which not a single student in my classes had ever heard of, even though it is only a chapter or so removed from the famous story of the baby Moses being found in a basket in the Nile River by the Pharaoh's daughter. We are told how Moses, grown to manhood and living in the land of Midian, is commissioned by God to go back to Egypt and deliver his people from bondage. Everything seems to be just fine. God and Moses like each other. Moses obediently starts on his trip, and suddenly, abruptly, we come upon one of the most bizarre stories in the entire Bible, beginning like this. At a lodging place, on the way, the Lord met him and sought to kill him. No hint as to why God was angry. And as one of my students very properly asked, why would he have to meet Moses somewhere and try to kill him? Why couldn't he just point a finger from on high and go zap? Why not indeed? The next couple of verses say that Moses' wife then circumcised her son and touched somebody's feet with the little bit of flesh. You can't tell for sure whose feet from the text. And said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me, whatever that means. And God let him alone. End of story. Four verses. Spend a few hours reading the finest critical commentaries you can find in the library, watching the scholars try to make sense of that one. And the one thing you'll be sure of when you finish is that the Bible is not an easy book. Not there, and not in a great many other places. Because even after you do the research, you have to end up making your own decision. Are you going to read that story as a literal historical event, or as a piece of religious folklore designed to have meaning for a few people centuries ago, but with no real meaning for any of us? Are you going to believe that the eternal God himself, that infinite energy and wisdom we've been taught to worship in the name of love, actually waylaid Moses at a wayside motel to kill him? Unless a child had minor surgery on the spot? Or is the Bible, among so many good and useful things, also a record of strange customs half hidden by the mists of centuries, so that we have to make choices all the time as to what remains relevant and what is no longer relevant at all? While we're still getting started with this short series, let me give you another example of a story in 2 Kings which presents a reader with some problems. There is a prophet in those pages by the name of Elisha. And one day, as he goes along the road, A group of naughty little boys tease him by calling him Old Baldhead. Now, they probably deserved to be grounded or to have their TV privileges denied for a week, but every ounce of common sense we have is challenged when we read the rest of the story. Then the prophet turned and cursed them in the name of the Lord, and two she-bears came out of the woods and mangled them. Talk about excessive use of force. We'd put Elisha in jail for uncontrollable temper and multiple murder. How do we make such a story acceptable to our sense of mercy and fair play? One of my students said, if God is love, he did not send bears out of the woods to tear up 42 little children for a verbal insult. So this must be some kind of religious propaganda rather than history. At which point another young man, taught by his church to read each word in the Bible as literal truth, said with great emotion, God can kill anybody he wants to, and he knows best. He had no choice but to violate his own sense of logic and kindness in order to insist on literalism. But literalism, sooner or later, turns the Bible into nonsense. If you read the closing verses of Exodus, chapter 33, you find a strange little story in which God is represented as passing by Moses and putting his hands over Moses' eyes so that my face shall not be seen. Why not? Well, because the story says unequivocally, man shall not see me and live. But astonishingly, if you look at an earlier verse in the very same chapter, you are told that the Lord used to speak with Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. A verse that clearly says it happened more than once and that it happened as naturally as one of us would speak to our next door neighbor. So which is it? Man shall not see me and live, or God and Moses talked face to face on a regular basis? And then there was Jacob, who wrestled one night with a mysterious stranger and said when it was over, I have seen God face to face. But in the New Testament, the author of the first epistle of John says, no man has seen God at any time. Which author has it right? Because if we read literally, not all of those statements can be true. One is fact, and one is poetry, perhaps. But which is which? Did God actually walk in the Garden of Eden in the cool of the evening, as if heat and humidity were a problem for him? And did he have solid weight so that Adam and Eve could hear his feet breaking twigs, as the book of Genesis clearly indicates? Or is God a spirit, invisible to mortal eyes, as the New Testament seems so clearly to tell us? If our children do not learn how to read these things, how to understand which parts of the Bible are eternally true and useful, and which parts are only the curious relics of a time gone by, they can fall easy victims to a rigid literalism that closes the mind and often disrupts friendships, and families. I would like for this church to promote knowledge under the great challenge of Jesus Himself, who said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." We think that the greatest jailer in this world is ignorance. So let's talk about these things for a few Sundays, about what it means to say the Bible is inspired, about what a dangerous book the Bible can be in careless or dishonest hands, about why the world is full of so many different opinions as to what it means. I hope you'll want to come back and hear more, and I shall tease you with a special incentive to be here on March the 20th, a couple of weeks from this morning, when we will have an unusual treat in the form of some visiting singers who will make you glad you came. Thank you for listening the way you do, and may your week be better for having been in this room.